Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. During his long career in politics, I've seen Chuck Schumer yell and scream. I've seen Chuck Schumer argue and debate. I've seen Chuck Schumer spin and dissemble. But until yesterday, I've never seen Chuck Schumer cry.
This executive order... was mean-spirited and un-American. It was implemented in a way that created chaos and confusion across the country, and it will only serve to embolden and inspire those around the globe who will do us harm. It must be reversed immediately. Senate Democrats are going to introduce legislation to overturn this and move it as quickly as we can. And I, as your senator from New York, will claw, scrap, and fight with every fiber of my being.
Senator Schumer yesterday at the protest in Lower Manhattan over President Trump's travel ban. And what a weekend of spontaneous protest all over the country. In the age of social media, Donald Trump can roil stock markets and world affairs with a tweet. But pop-up protests can also be mobilized in an instant. You all know, I'm sure, about JFK Airport on Saturday and Saturday night, also at so many other airports around the country, and in Lower Manhattan yesterday, too, with just one day's notice, where Schumer wasn't the only speaker to shed a tear. This is a Bronx resident who also spoke.
And I am a good citizen. I have my own business. I have my own house. But I don't have my children with me. It's very hard to see people being killed right and left, and I can't save my own children. So, I have another daughter in Lebanon stuck there with four children. They cannot get here. And I appreciate Mr. Senator Schumer for his efforts, and he's going to fight this nonsense, because America's it's built on refugees and people like us building America, and we're going to build it better than what Mr. Trump wanted it. Good. And I promise you that. And this future of America, I've been bringing my kids here to be a good citizen. I'm teaching my wife as a teacher, educators. She teach them, well, we all teach them to be good and do good for America and for everybody.
One of the New Yorkers whose family is affected by the travel ban speaking at the Lower Manhattan protest yesterday. But what is this ban, really? Is it a Muslim entry ban, as protesters are decrying? White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer insists not.
There are 46 other countries with Muslim populations that are not part of this. And I think that that's an important thing to note. So whether you're talking about Algeria, Jordan, Kuwait, Oman, or the UAE, there's 46 Muslim-majority countries that are not in the seven. These seven countries were identified by the Obama administration needing further travel.
But what about the countries like Pakistan, like Afghanistan, where there have been terrorist
attacks, we're
gonna Saudi continue. Arabia
we're
looking on 9/11.
At this, we're looking at all of this holistically. But I think the first step
but
was
why
to
these
look,
first, where the, there haven't been
I just said it
attacks.
Twice, because I think these were the Obama administration put these first and foremost and said that these countries need to have further travel restrictions based on the intelligence that we have.
Sean Spicer with Martha Raddatz yesterday on ABC This Week. He was contradicted, in a way, by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani on Fox News Channel on Saturday, who seemed to reveal that this is a way to do a Muslim ban with legal cover.
When he first announced it, he said Muslim ban. He called me up. He said, put a commission together. Show me the right way to do it legally. I put a commission together with Judge Mukasey, with Congressman McCall, Pete King, whole group of other very expert lawyers on this. And what we did was we focused on, instead of religion, danger. The areas of the world that create danger for us. which is a factual basis, not a religious basis. Perfectly legal, perfectly sensible, and that's what the ban is based on.
Rudy Giuliani on Fox News Channel, when he first announced it, Giuliani said, he said, Muslim ban. He called me up and he said, put a commission together. Show me the right way to do it legally. So, wow. New York fingerprints on so much of this. Trump and Giuliani and Peter King, who Giuliani mentioned there, Congressman King, and Steve Bannon has lived in New York, and Chuck Schumer crying. Listeners, we'll devote almost our whole program to this morning, and we invite your stories, your questions, and your opinions from any point of view. Listeners, what's at stake for you? Anyone personally affected with family members in limbo, or maybe you yourself? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. Anyone else too? Is this consistent or inconsistent with American values as you understand them? What else would you like to say or to ask our first guest, NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Mara Liasson does join us now. Mara, we always appreciate the time. We know you're so busy, especially these days. Good morning.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
To Sean Spicer's point at the end of that ABC News clip, can you explain the part about these countries being identified by the Obama administration?
I think, you mean where he talked about the seven countries being identified?
Yeah, the countries subject to the
ban. I think what he's talking about is, to the best of my knowledge, these seven countries were identified as countries that were dangerous to visit. So they clearly were designated as dangerous countries by the Obama administration. I don't think it's right to say that they were identified as the main source of terrorists threats to the United States.
And the part about 46 countries with large Muslim populations not being part of the ban, how are the Democrats arguing that it is a Muslim ban in light of that?
Well, the Supreme Court is going to decide whether it's a Muslim ban or not, whether it's a religious test, which would be unconstitutional. But what the Democrats and the opponents of this are arguing is that this was a religious test because the president has said many times we want to prioritize Christians. But they have to prove that because they didn't just make a sweeping ban on Muslims. They chose seven countries. This is all going to be adjudicated. The president issued a statement yesterday that said this isn't a Muslim ban. The media is lying about this. And when asked why other Muslim countries, other Muslim majority countries that have been the country of origin for terrorists who have attacked the United States in the past, why weren't they included? The answer has been, from several Trump administration officials, well, we might be adding more countries to the list later.
And of course, this is a deeply felt issue. We see it from the size of the spontaneous protests. Have you ever heard Chuck Schumer cry before?
No, I have never heard Chuck Schumer cry. I've watched the tape. My impression was it was totally, of the moment. And I think it was real. Today, Donald Trump weighed in and said he thinks it's fake. He said, Charles Schumer with fake tears. I'm going to ask him who his acting coach is. I know him. I've seen him do this, do that, do this, but I've never seen him cry. I think there's a 5% chance those tears were real. Well, maybe some people thought there was a 5% chance that Donald Trump would be elected. I'll leave it to people who want to go and watch the video, what they think of Chuck Schumer's tears, but they look pretty real to me.
David French, in a National Review article, legal analysis from his perspective, says there's an overreaction to this order that doesn't match the facts and that it's not inconsistent with American values on refugees. For example, on the Trump order limiting total refugee admissions to 50,000 once the program starts up again, 50,000 this year, French writes that President Obama only admitted about 50,000 refugees in 2011 and 2012, 70,000 in 2013 to 2015, which is not that many more. He also says in 2002, 3, 6, and 7, there were less than 50,000. If you know these numbers, Mara, I don't know if this is in your, reporting bucket, but fair enough to say 50,000 would not be aberrationally low?
Yes, look, fair enough to say that. But here's the problem with the living in the era of Trump and reacting to things that Trump does. I think it's fair to say this could be an overreaction to Trump's order on the practical effects of it. But there are other effects of it. And I think that the reaction that you saw, the spontaneous protests at airports, the tears that were shed by many people who feel they'll never see their country again, by the anguish that you heard from national security experts and some Republican senators in Washington that this was going to create a backlash and create the exact opposite thing that we want. In other words, it's going to endanger our national security because we're sending a message to ISIS, basically, you were right, we are at war with Muslims. Now, I know that that's not what the White House would say, but there's so many layers to this. And also, you know, the idea that the United States is a welcoming country, that America is an idea. It's not just a country, it's an idea. We stand for things. And Donald Trump, not just with this order, but with his inaugural address and many other things that he's done, has really changed that radically. So the reaction to this order, I think, has all of those other pieces going on, too. As a practical matter, yes, this could end up being not much more than the Obama administration did. But the Obama administration also made an effort to send a message to the rest of the world about American values and what we want to stand for as the world's only democratic superpower. So I think this is pretty complicated. I think, yes, on one level, this could end up on a practical level being not much different than what Obama did. But there's a lot more to this.
And one more set of stats on the same point, on the suspension of all refugees from Syria. David French argues the Obama administration, until last year, had pretty much slammed the door on Syrian refugees, starting from after the civil war began there. Just 31 Syrian refugees taken in fiscal year 2012, 36 in 2013, 105 in 2015, and 1,600 after that. And then last year it went up to 13,000. But those are not big numbers. Do you know why?
No, the Obama administration was under pressure to take more.
Yeah.
You know, yes. And the thing is, the Obama administration didn't take very many. They also had a very onerous, long vetting process. Along comes Donald Trump and says, we're going to shut it down completely. And we don't want him here. And he believes that Syrian refugees are a source of danger to the United States. And you know, that's a little bit different when you accompany the decrease in the number of refugees that you're going to take or the complete suspension of taking refugees from a certain country. And you do it with a lot of rhetoric that tells the rest of the world, we're not willing to take people, even people who prove that they're really refugees. You know, I think it causes a reaction.
Let's start taking some phone calls with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mustafa in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mustafa.
Hi, Brian. I just have two things to say. My cousin, who I haven't seen in almost 20 years, I myself am an Iraqi immigrant to the U.S. My cousin, who I have not seen in 20 years, was coming to visit today, and she canceled her visits. She's a dual Canadian-Iraqi citizen. But because this could actually include her, she just canceled her visit. And the other thing I have to say is that, yes, everybody is saying it's practical, it's practically small, but this is how things start. I saw this in Iraq many years ago when Saddam started with Iraqis of Persian descent. Nobody cared. There were very few of them in Iraq. This is the same thing with President Smallhands. He's doing the same thing.
And Mustafa, later in the show, we're going to have two guests. One, Emily Bazelon from the New York Times, who's a legal analyst, coming up after Mara. And then next hour, we're going to have Alan Wernick from CUNY, who does individual advice for people with tricky immigration questions. And maybe we can get some clarification on whether your cousin, because she has Canadian citizenship as well as Iraqi, might be able to come into the country. We'll get a lot of people's individual questions on, especially with Alan Wernick coming up later. But I'm going to make a note to try to ask him about your cousin's status under this ban and whether she may be able to come in anyway. So thank you for your call. Samir in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Samir.
Yes, the chief architect of this Muslim ban was Bannon, and the Gestapo type of program, which caused a pogrom in a Canadian mosque where 30 people were shot up is just the beginning. And like the earlier caller said, this is just the beginning of the next thing would be against the Jews, like how much they control. So this is just to precipitate Trump's internal agenda of hate.
Samir, thank you for your call and your opinion. Mara Liasson, he mentioned Bannon. There's a growing awareness of how central a role Steve Bannon, the former Breitbart chairman, the ideological heart of the administration, I guess, seems to be playing in policymaking overall. There's a protest hashtag spreading on Twitter, Stop President Bannon. What do you know? What can you say factually about his role in writing this?
Yeah, I think you've described it correctly. I mean, he has a very central role in the White House. He's the keeper of the nationalist populist ideological flame that animates Trump. And he wrote the inaugural address. He's been the author of a lot of these executive orders. He's been elevated to a position to be part of the Principals Committee of the National Security Council, which is something that neither Karl Rove nor David Axelrod, who held his position in the last two administrations, had. This means he goes to principals meetings with the top national security officials in the cabinet. And when Donald Trump, by executive order, gave him a role on the Principals Committee, he removed the director of national intelligence and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from that Principals Committee. Doesn't mean they can't come if they're invited, but they don't have a regular official position.
So did
so
that
has
actually
a very, very
change?
Central role.
I saw Sean Spicer on television this morning, the press secretary, saying they weren't downgraded if you read the executive order, and that's been a misunderstanding. Is it clear to you what it is?
Okay, well, then it's not clear to me that, well, maybe it depends on the definition of the word downgraded. But I think that when you see the list of people who are on the Principals Committee, who as a matter of course go to these meetings, I don't think the DNI or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff will be on that. That doesn't mean they can't go to meetings as necessary and as invited. So maybe they need to just clarify that a little bit.
And the Trump people are saying that Steve Bannon going to those meetings is not the same as political advisors from the past administrations like David Axelrod for Obama or Karl Rove for George W. Bush, because they're just politics people. That Steve Bannon also was a naval officer and has a broad geopolitical sense. He certainly has a geopolitical worldview.
Karl Rove would have said that he had a geopolitical worldview. I don't know if he served in the military, but Karl Rove had a pretty big worldview.
Trey in Rockland County, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Hey, thank you, man, for having me on. Oh, my goodness. I'm listening to this, and I'm confused. I feel like I'm in an episode of The Twilight Zone. Okay, let me make a disclaimer. I'm African-American male, okay? Just by voting stats, it seems that we voted the least out of all the demographics for this president, okay? The women marched, but more than 50% of white women voted for Trump, okay? A whole bunch of Hispanic people of Spanish descent voted for Trump. A lot of immigrants voted for Trump, coming from various nationalities. And now they're all marching, they're all crying, they're all doing this and that, like they didn't have a clue that he would try and get rid of abortion, like they didn't have a clue that he was going to build this wall, that he was going to make a Muslim ban. He said all of these things while he was campaigning. Meanwhile, the one demographic that he can't sit anywhere because there's no place. I mean, we're safe, African Americans. This is about as home as we're ever going to get. We're like the American Indian as far as that's concerned. There is no sending us anywhere. Okay, but all these other people, what was on their mind? That's all I want to know.
But what?
Where's the buyer's remorse from?
Well, I don't know that it was a lot of people who voted for Trump who are now protesting this. Although I saw one on TV at Kennedy Airport last on Saturday night who said to the New York One cameras, I voted for Trump. We should give him a chance. I support most of his agenda, but not this. And that was really interesting. But I'm sure he was very much in the minority. So, Trey, are you trying to scold people for not having voted in large enough numbers, or what's your point?
I'm saying the whole – no, it's like people didn't think this through. They didn't think it through. A lot of people, they made protest votes. You know, whether it was for the Green Party or they right. voted for Mickey Mouse or they didn't vote at all. And now we got this. And we're going to have 4 years of this. So just buckle your seatbelt. It's only just begun. And hopefully next time around, people will go to the polls with some sense.
Trey, thank you very much. And, of course, what we're seeing in the streets and at the airports is people saying we don't have to only buckle our seatbelts. We can take action and push back against things that we think are wrong or un-American. But Mara Liasson, to the beginning of the point that he made, Trump is beginning to make good on his central campaign promises.
Yeah, I just want to say I thought that caller was great.
Me too.
Is one smart New Yorker. I used to be one myself, or not the smart part, just the New Yorker part. Anyway, look, the famous line from Selena Zito of The Atlantic during the campaign was that Trump supporters took him seriously but not literally, and everyone else took him literally but not seriously. So it turns out we should take him seriously and literally. He meant what he said. He is methodically going about fulfilling his campaign promises, telling the people who voted for him, yes, I said I was going to build the wall. And I am going to build the wall. I said I was going to ban Muslims, although now I'm not putting a religious test on it. As Rudy Giuliani said, Trump came to him and said, I want a Muslim ban, but I want it to be legal and constitutional. Can you help me do that? So, yes, all those people who either thought a vote for Trump was a protest vote or they voted for him because they were sure Hillary would win and it was kind of like a free vote to show that they were fed up with the system, or they didn't vote at all, or they voted for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. Yes, you know, this is serious business. And what's interesting to me, just as a political journalist, is we don't expect that the kind of hardcore 37% or 38% of Trump's base is going to change. As a matter of fact, I think they'll be very happy with almost everything he does.
I would think so.
And the White House feels it's on very strong ground on this, by the way, this refugee policy, because they think that the majority of people in the country want every measure taken to protect us against terrorism. But what I'm interested in is the other 10% between the 37 that brought him up to the 46% he got. What are they thinking now?
And it's too early.
And maybe there's a clue because his approval ratings have dropped below his ballot. Normally, your approval rating should be way above your ballot at this point in a brand new administration.
Right. And that was happening even before the election. I mean,
right.
before the inauguration.
Before this executive order, right.
And before the executive order.
Right.
And I guess it's just too early to gauge reaction of that 10% or whatever percentage you'd say is sort of in the middle from any polling, right?
Well, yeah, we don't have a lot of polling. The only polling we have on this, on the refugee ban, is something that was done earlier this month by Quinnipiac, where by 48% to 42%, people agreed with the statement we should suspend immigration from terror-prone countries. So, you know, they were positive about it. What they think now, after they see the kind of disruption this has caused, we'll see. We're waiting for polling.
Samira in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Samira.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
Well, I'm calling because I feel like people don't understand that the extreme vetting actually has been existing for many, many years, especially for Iranians. I've been here since 2008 on a student visa. I came here to do my PhD in a STEM field. And because I've been in STEM, they're doing this background check on me every time I leave the U.S. and come back. So I've been able to go home once in 8 years, and I was going to defend my PhD and go home and come back in the fall, but I decided to stay on because I can't leave. I'm not going to be able to come back in the fall and continue in the program, in the new program that I want to study. And, you know, this is a story of, like, I feel like I'm a privileged person going to grad school. More people in this country go to prison than grad school. I understand that, you know, privilege. But at the same time, it's just so frustrating that every single decision that I've been making for the past 8 years in my life is based on this inability to be mobile as a person in the world. And I don't understand why Americans, especially white people, they don't even understand how their system works, and they make all these judgments, and they send people so easily to places that they're actually unsafe. I have friends who were basically detained at the airport, and there were really some of them, but some were sent back to Iran. This is not fair. Like, this is people's, like, actual material life that they're playing with.
Did you hear the story of the Iranian student from Stony Brook?
Yes, that's my friend.
That's
yes.
Your friend? Would you tell me that story as you know it from your friend?
Yeah, so the thing is, I received letters. I wasn't in touch with her personally, but school has been sending emails, and I was also in touch with some friends who were in touch with her. And she was basically treated really horribly. And, I mean, they don't understand. When you're going into, you know, the first time I entered the U.S., they took me to in this room, and there for 3-4 hours they were just making me fill out these forms, and the bureaucracy is just, you know, mind-numbing and crazy. But I can only imagine this friend Vahida, who was detained, they also play this power trip that they're constantly, you know, accusing you of things, or they're trying to make you break or not give you the, you know, simple rights. They take away your phone. They, you know, they just snoop into your private emails or private messages. This can't be right. And if you deny it, they make you sign all these forms that could revoke your visa. And who can fight that shit from outside the U.S.?
I understand that your friend was actually put on a plane to go back to Iran to be deported.
That's another friend, yes.
That's a different person. Was taxiing on the runway when...
Yeah, so I can tell you that story. She's actually my friend Syra. She's a CUNY student. And she basically was getting on the plane from Abu Dhabi to come to JFK, and they didn't even allow her to get on the flight. And then they took her passport and they gave it to the crew. And then when she landed in Iran, she didn't even have her passport, and they gave her passport to the Iranian authorities. I mean, they don't understand. This is like risking somebody's life. And she has to now go and deal with Iranian authorities and get her passport and figure out if she still has her visa or not. And she's, you know, she's a PhD student. This is her life. She, you know, she tried so hard to get admitted and get funding and all of that. And now all her life is just gone in a second.
Samira, in your opinion, having gone through the experiences you've gone through, but also knowing the real terrorism threats in the world, what do you think legitimate vetting would be of people in your situation or similar?
Legitimate vetting for, I mean, Brian, you know, this is just a game. This is just a political performance and theater. They are not keeping anyone safe. If America was really, really worried about people's safety, then I don't know. Why are they going after all these white men who are shooting everyone on the street every day? And this is not, they are not, none of these, tell me about a terrorist attack in the U.S. from, like, a Muslim person who was attached to ISIS. Like, how many of them have happened? Zero. This is ridiculous, and they're not keeping anyone safe. And in terms of, like, asking for background checks from these countries that they've actually basically marginalized, you think the Islamic Republic is going to give them any information on their citizens? No, of course not. There's no relationship whatsoever. So my dad wanted to come here and see me defend my PhD, but he can't because his visa hasn't been cleared for over a year. So, I mean, I don't know what they're, like, looking for. This is not going to keep anyone safe. And forget about Iranians. I feel like we are in a more privileged position. Think about all the Syrians who've gone through, like, seas and oceans. And, you know, they've been just, you know, torn apart. And this is just so inhumane. I don't understand how this is okay for Americans to watch. Because I feel like Americans have never really experienced what it means to have a bomb thrown on your house and be destroyed, except 9/11, that everyone was, of course.
And there have been other terrorist incidents, San Bernardino, and, you know, I could mention the other ones.
But of course, but San Bernardino still, like, still the evidence is not out there that he was connected to ISIS. What about all the other shootings that happened in, you know, Connecticut, that happened in, like, movie theaters? I mean, are they all ISIS connected? These are all, like, American citizens.
Samira, thank you very much for your call. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And NPR's Mara Liasson, there was a list released by the Cato Institute over the weekend, the libertarian think tank, which tends to be conservative on economics and kind of liberal, very non-interventionist on foreign policy, the libertarian perspective. And they released a list of the number of terrorist attacks in the United States linked to people from each of the seven countries in the travel ban. And you may have seen it already. The number for every single one of the seven was zero.
Sure. Sure. Look, this is these policies have a lot of repercussions way beyond how many people are detained at the airport, what kind of experience they had in the holding room, you know, how many questions they were asked. This is a national – this is foreign policy. Donald Trump is conducting foreign policy. With every word he utters, he sends a message to the world that is going to have – potentially blowback. All the countries that are not on this list that have had people commit terrorist acts in the United States, you know, are they going to be more motivated to do that? Are people right now becoming self-radicalized in the United States because they see Donald Trump sending a message, you know, the U.S. is at war with Islam? I'm not saying that's what the White House said. I'm just saying there's what the president says, mm-hmm. and then there's what people hear. And there are a lot of national security experts who say this is exactly what you should do if you want to motivate more people to commit terrorist acts against the United States.
Let me ask you one more thing, and then we're going to bring on Emily Bazelon for a legal analysis. We'll see how close we can come to an answer about how constitutional or unconstitutional some of the things in this travel ban are. But, Mara, this, I believe, is your fourth transition as an NPR national political reporter.
I don't know about – well, when Clinton came in, and think about
right?
it.
When Clinton came in, then
Clinton,
Bush.
Clinton and Obama and – I wasn't a White House reporter during Bush. I was working for NPR, obviously. But yeah, I guess you could say I've been around for four.
As a national political reporter. So yep. Are the media making too much of the flurry of activity, calling it chaos, or, you know, because there's always the advice to new presidents to put a lot of the things you want to do in the pipeline right away, because that's when you have the most political clout.
Yeah, I think it's really important to kind of separate out the things that Donald Trump is doing that any conservative Republican new president would do, the things he's doing that have potentially world-altering effects, the thing that he's doing that would have effects on our basic democratic institutions. I mean, there's a lot of different levels to this. He has actually not issued any more executive orders than President Obama did at this time. Every president has a flurry of activity. This is the time generally when they're at their highest approval rating. That's Donald Trump is the exception to that rule, where that you want to get a lot of things done. You want to prove to people that you meant what you said during the campaign, and he's doing that. What's unusual is not that he's issuing a lot of executive orders. What's unusual is that some of those executive orders are upending or wiping out 70 years of a bipartisan foreign policy consensus about America's role in the world and how America stands for values around the world and how it exercises its power, soft power and hard power, as the world's only democratic superpower. That's what we should be focusing on. And in terms of the chaos, I covered Bill Clinton's transition. It was pretty chaotic. The whole gays in the military episode happened. I don't know if it happened on week one, but it happened very, very early. It actually might have happened on week one. So that's not terribly unusual, a little chaos in a new administration. But because Donald Trump represents such an ideological break, such a radical break with his own party's traditional philosophy, with, you know, like I said, 70 years of a bipartisan foreign policy consensus about America's role in the world, that is what is important.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emily Bazelon next with legal analysis. Stay with us.